So starting over, we're talking about carbohydrate metabolism. There's other kinds of metabolic pathways, fatty acid, amino acid. Those will be covered next semester. And we will also actually revisit the carbohydrate pathways next semester in significantly more detail. But for right now, we're going to look at each of the carbohydrate pathways. And to begin that, today we will do an overview talking about a bit more about the structure of carbohydrates or sugars. And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about the thermodynamics, the energy. We'll talk about ATP and the energy of the pathways. And then finally, we'll get into the individual pathways. So, of course, to talk about carbohydrates, we're talking about sugars. The simplest one is a monosaccharide. And the monosaccharide can either be an aldehyde or ketone derivative. And glucose, our most common and familiar sugar, is an aldehyde derivative. And that means it is an aldose, and you can see its open chain structure. You can also see we number the carbons starting at the top, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 carbons in glucose. So it is a hexose, and you'll notice right next to it another common sugar, fruit sugar or fructose, is a ketose because it has ketone functionality. Again, you see the carbonyl functionality is a ketone rather than an aldehyde. It's also got 6 carbons, so it is a hexose. So there are pentoses and hexoses. When fructose cyclizes, it actually becomes a 5-membered ring, so it will be a pentose ring when it cyclizes. And you'll see in a minute, we never talk about open chain or straight chain sugars. We talk about them in a cyclic fashion because that's how they are found primarily, so they're not floating around in our body's open chain, but in their cyclic counterparts. And you will notice there are a lot of chiral carbons. And you hopefully remember asymmetric or chiral from organic chemistry, meaning the carbon has 4 different chemical groups attached to it. And pretty much with the exception of the CH2OH and then the carbonyl carbon, all of the carbons in the sugars are chiral. And you will notice glucose then has 4 chiral carbons, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and fructose has 3, 4, and 5 chiral carbons. And so the stereochemistry of sugars is actually fairly complex. There's a lot of stereoisomers, and 2 to the N, N being the number of chiral carbons, possible stereoisomers. So lots of stereoisomers possible. We're not going to worry too much about those. And hopefully you remember also enantiomers, mirror images, but most sugars in the body are D, so we have D and L sugars, so we're just going to concentrate on the D ones. So kind of like with the amino acids, we had only one form that we concentrated on, the D amino acids not being natural. The sugars, we're going to concentrate only on the D form and not the L form. So non-superimposable mirror images, enantiomers. So you can see glucose there has cyclized. So we see it in its open chain form, and we see it in 2 ring forms. And you notice it's forming now a 6-membered ring. And that ring is called a pyranose ring when it has 6 members to the ring, and furanose when there's 5. Hopefully, you can look at the straight chain form, and you can see the carbon number 1, which is part of the aldehyde functionality. And when it cyclizes, and again, you can locate, because it's labeled 1 on the cyclic pyranose forms of glucose, the carbon which was the aldehyde, the carbonyl carbon, has become chiral when the sugar cyclized. And that new chiral carbon that forms when we cyclize the sugar has a special name. It's called the anomeric carbon. The anomeric carbon. So that's the new asymmetric or new chiral carbon that's formed when the sugar cyclizes. And when we look at that anomeric carbon, you can see it can go 2 different ways. That is, the hydroxyl group can go either up or down when the sugar cyclizes. So we have a 50% chance of it going up and 50% chance of it going down. And we name those molecules, the cyclic form, the pyranose ring, depending on whether that OH group is up or it's down. And if the OH group is down, we call it alpha. If it happens to land up, we call it beta. So that's why those are called alpha D glucopyranose and beta D glucopyranose. Because looking at the asymmetric the new asymmetric carbon, also known as the anomeric carbon, the new chiral carbon, carbon number one. Look at that OH group. Did it land down or did it land up? So if it landed down, that's the alpha. If it landed up, that's the beta. That's the beta. And there's a couple of other examples here that you can look at. Fructose. When fructose cyclizes, and remember fructose started out as a ketose, so the new chiral carbon, the anomeric carbon, will actually be carbon number two. Because look back at the straight chain form of fructose, carbon number two is the ketone, or the carbonyl carbon. So it will now be the new anomeric, the new chiral carbon. And again, you can look at the OH group attached directly, and is it up or is it down? And again, if it's down, it's alpha, and the example here in your picture is alpha. If it were up, and we have 50% chance, it will be beta D-fructose. You also see here galactose, or galactopyranose, which cyclized. And galactose is very similar to glucose. Carbon number one is the aldehyde or carbonyl carbon, which becomes the new chiral, or what we call anomeric carbon. Anomeric carbon. And again, look at the OH group. Is it up or down? You can figure out if it's alpha or beta. Well, that's not the only reason we're interested in the anomeric carbon. The other reason is that we like to look at that hydroxyl group, and the first thing we say, is it up or down, so we can call it alpha or beta. The other thing we do is look at the hydroxyl group and look at the state of the oxygen on the hydroxyl group, which is attached to the anomeric carbon. If that oxygen is pretty much free, in other words, remember, anytime we draw an OH group, there's extra pairs of electrons on the oxygen. If those electrons are free to oxidize metals such as copper or iron, then we call that sugar a reducing sugar. If that oxygen is attached to something else or involved in a bond with either another sugar, a phosphate group, any number of things it could be bonded to, then that oxygen can't donate its electrons to reduce copper or iron, and we call that a non-reducing sugar. So we can determine if a sugar is reducing or not, and we do this in the lab, and I think you've already done the carbohydrate lab, those of you that have been in there, and have determined certain sugars to be reducing or non-reducing. And in the lab, we do it by color, because when we react reducing and non-reducing sugars with copper, we see blue colors coming and going, and dark blues and light blues. And so we can determine then in the lab if something is reducing or non-reducing. So we're going to look at the anomeric carbon, not just to determine alpha, beta, but is it a reducing sugar? Now, it's simple when we're talking about monosaccharides, but of course, a lot of sugars are polysaccharides, and the most common ones are maltose, sucrose, or table sugar, and lactose, which we've already mentioned before, is milk sugar. So as we look then at polysaccharides, or in this case they're disaccharides, it's a little bit more difficult to determine whether the sugar is reducing or non-reducing. However, we can still do that. The first thing we do is look at the disaccharide and figure out what are its monosaccharide components. So what are the components of the disaccharide? Well, as we look at maltose, we see a glucose and a glucose. So basically two glucoses come together. We call that sugar maltose. As you look at the name of the sugar, again, you see alphas, and those alphas are referring to what happens to the hydroxyl group on the anomeric carbon. The one with the star on it is the anomeric carbon, and we know that it's also carbon number one for glucose. So you've got two anomeric carbons. In both cases, the hydroxyl group is down, so we have alpha maltose. Then as we look also at the name, you see the one arrow four. What that refers to is how these two sugars are connected to each other. So they're connected between carbon 1 on the first molecule of glucose to carbon 4 of the second molecule of glucose. So the name tells you a little bit more about the structure. And you're not going to have to name it in its long form. This is maltose. It's not O-alpha-D-glucopyranosyl-1-4. That's the long name. But the long name does give you a bit more information, as the longer classic names tend to do. So the 1-4 tells you where the bonds are. Then as you look at those anomeric carbons, the one with the stars, or carbon number one, because we're talking about glucose, you can see that the first anomeric carbon, that oxygen is actually involved in something. It's involved in a bond, a glycosidic bond to a second glucose molecule. As you look at the second glucose molecule, however, the oxygen on that anomeric carbon is totally free. It is not bonded to anything else. So when we go in the lab, we can take some maltose and do the test using copper, and we will see that maltose is a reducing sugar because the second hydroxyl group on the second anomeric carbon is free to donate electrons to oxidation-reduction reactions. So a little harder to tell. We have to look at both anomeric carbons and see, does one of them have a free oxygen, free hydroxyl group? The next molecule is table sugar, also known as sucrose. It's composed of glucose and fructose, again, two familiar sugars. We know glucose, the anomeric carbon, is carbon number one, and for fructose, it's carbon number two. So again, looking at both of the anomeric carbons there, we see that the oxygen, again, is down in both cases, so we're talking about an alpha sucrose here. And the other thing we notice is, interestingly, in sucrose, the glycosidic bond between the two monosaccharides is a carbon 1 connecting to carbon 2. So in this case, both of those anomeric carbons are involved in a bond. They're part of the glycosidic bond. So sucrose is not a reducing sugar. There is no hydroxyl group attached to an anomeric carbon that is totally free to donate electrons to reduce copper or iron. So again, in the lab, you actually did this, and you determine sucrose via colors and using the spectrophotometer is a non-reducing sugar. And the last and one of the more common is lactose. So here we have lactose. And you will notice, what is lactose? And we already talked about this when we talked about lactose intolerance. It's a combination of galactose and glucose, which is digested, remember, by the enzyme lactase. So lactase breaks these apart, giving us galactose and glucose. The first thing you notice, find the anomeric carbons. We're talking about galactose and glucose, so we're talking about carbon number one on each of those molecules, the one with the star on it. And you look at the hydroxyl group, and you notice in both cases it's up. So in this case, we have a beta disaccharide. And you look at both of them, and you see carbon number one for the galactose molecule is involved in the glycosidic bond, so those electrons are not free. The carbon number one of the glucose ring, when we look at the anomeric carbon, that hydroxyl group is free. The electrons are free to reduce copper. So again, something you did in the lab, you figured out that lactose is a reducing sugar. So maltose and lactose are reducing sugars, and sucrose is not. So again, a little bit more important in the lab where we can play with those kind of things. And again, don't worry about those long names. You don't have to use the full all-out classical organic chemistry name, although it does give us, again, a bit more information about what's happening in the sugar. So sugar. We're also going to talk about glycogen, and when we talk about glycogen, keep in mind that there are polysaccharides, and glycogen is going to basically be a huge polymer of glucose. So glucose is going to be attached, many, 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 many thousands of glucose molecules to form glycogen. And we will be talking about glycogen. So keep that one in mind when you think of polysaccharides. Now, before we continue, there's a couple of hormones that are important to carbohydrate metabolism. And they are insulin and glucagon. Thank you. insulin and glucagon, both proteins, both hormones, probably heard of both of them, particularly insulin. And they are basically what controls plasma glucose levels. So when you eat, ingest sugars, proteins, fats, etc., your plasma glucose levels increase. This signals your pancreas to release a hormone called insulin. It is insulin that allows many of our tissues, I won't say many, I would say most of our tissues, to utilize the glucose as energy. So it allows them to transport it across their plasma membranes inside the cell and begin to use it as energy to do all of their cellular functions. In a fasted state, and most of us never enter quite this much of a fasted state, it really is something we'll study next semester. There's a number of hours after eating the last meal that you finally enter this kind of state. And that is when glucose levels begin to fall, plasma glucose levels. Again, the pancreas is signaled, but this time to release rather the sister hormone of insulin called glucagon. And glucagon is a hormone that is able to then create or produce glucose to raise plasma glucose levels. So insulin overall is lowering your plasma glucose levels by allowing your body to utilize the glucose in your blood. And glucagon overall raises plasma glucose levels to give you energy that you need. So with that in mind, there are three key tissues which are insulin insensitive. And what that means is when you eat, the increase in your plasma glucose levels is enough for these tissues to use the glucose. They do not have to wait around for the pancreas to release insulin, for insulin to be present. That is your red blood cells, your brain, and your liver. All three of those organelles, the red blood cell, the brain, and the liver, can use the glucose immediately without insulin being present. So that's what insulin insensitive means. They're not sensitive to whether insulin's there or not. They immediately begin to use the blood glucose. Red blood cells are pretty simple creatures. That's basically what they live on. They metabolize glucose, and we obviously have a lot of them. So it's a good thing that they can immediately begin to use the glucose. The brain, huge, huge requirements of glucose for energy. The brain can't use fats, counts really highly on glucose, and also ketones, which is something, again, we'll touch on next semester. It can use ketones as fuel. So the brain is a huge fuel consumer, uses a lot of glucose. And the liver, we're going to see, pretty much does everything in the body. Almost every metabolic pathway is occurring in the liver. Big powerhouse, does a whole lot of different things, signals different things. And so the liver can go ahead and also use glucose without waiting around for the pancreas to produce insulin. Now the rest of the tissues then fall underneath the red blood cell, the brain, and the liver, and they have to wait until insulin is on the scene and that they know that insulin has been released for them to be able to then use the rest of the glucose, and those would be things like the muscle and the adipose tissues. So once insulin's on the scene, then they can go ahead and begin to transport and use the plasma glucose. So insensitive ones are the red blood cell, the brain, and the liver. Pretty much everything else, and two examples of big consumers of glucose, muscle and adipose, have to wait until the pancreas produces and lets go of the insulin. Now this picture right here that we're coming to, and these pathways are really key to what we're going to be talking about for the remainder of the course. So in the next couple days, this picture should be in your mind, firmly there. You need to know these pathways. You need to know what's going on in this picture. And basically, at the middle parts of the picture, kind of the intersecting areas, you will see glucose-6-phosphate, pyruvate, and acetyl-CoA. And we're going to continue to bring up those three molecules as key intermediates over and over and over again. Glucose-6-phosphate, pyruvate, and acetyl-CoA. Looking at glucose-6-phosphate, notice we've got lots of arrows coming and going there. We will look at all of these pathways. Glucose-6-phosphate going to glycogen, in other words, making glycogen, is called glycogenesis. Glycogenesis. So we make glycogen, the genesis or creation of glycogen. We can also go the other way and take the glycogen, the glucose that we've stored, and make it into glucose-6-phosphate for use in other systems. And we call that glycogenolysis. So lysis of glycogen, breakdown of glycogen. We also have glycolysis, and you will see glucose-6-phosphate going to pyruvate, and actually we go from glucose, fructose, and galactose, as we will see, through glucose-6-phosphate to pyruvate. But classically, glucose-6-phosphate to pyruvate is the pathway of glycolysis. That's a key pathway, the first one we're going to look at, glycolysis. We can go backwards. We can produce glucose-6-phosphate from pyruvate, and that's called gluconeogenesis. Again, the genesis or the creation of glucose-6-phosphate, gluconeogenesis. Notice also glucose-6-phosphate can go through a pathway called the PPP, also known as the pentose phosphate pathway. That pathway has a number of things that it does, but the key thing is it makes NADPH, which is used in a lot of processes, including nucleic acid synthesis and a number of other pathways. And it also makes ribose, and we're going to see that when we talk about the pathway in some detail. So it makes NADPH and ribose, the pentose phosphate pathway, key for cell biosynthesis. Now down at pyruvate, which again we produced from glucose-6-phosphate via glycolysis, pyruvate can become lactic acid or lactate, and we're going to see that pathway. It doesn't really have a particular name. It can also continue on through an enzyme which we will become very familiar with called the PDH, pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, PDH. It's a very complicated enzyme that we will talk about, and it converts pyruvate to acetyl-CoA. Now, acetyl-CoA becomes, ultimately, the carbons, at least, in acetyl-CoA, become CO2, which we then respirate out. So CO2 goes out, oxygen comes in. That's the process of respiration. That pathway is called the citric acid cycle. That's where we get almost all of the energy for all of our cellular and metabolic processes, the citric acid cycle. We're going to talk about it. It's a round cycle. And the big key word, bold, big letters, capitals, energy, is what we will get from the citric acid cycle. So this is a key picture. You should know what these pathways are, what converts to what in the next couple of days. They're also summarized in terms of the actual pathways we will look at. Again, glycolysis is breaking down glucose. We will also see it break down galactose and fructose to pyruvate. Gluconeogenesis, so the genesis of glucose, is the conversion backwards of pyruvate to glucose. Glycogenesis, or the genesis or creation of glycogen, takes glucose-6-phosphate and we store it as glycogen. Glycogenolysis is breaking down glycogen into glucose-6-phosphate molecules. The pentose phosphate pathway makes NADPH and also ribose, which is a key in a lot of biosynthetic pathways. And then finally, the big one in terms of energy, in terms of ATP, which we're going to talk a lot about on Wednesday, is the citric acid cycle. So really key diagram, key pathways. Get those in your brain as quick as possible, and it will help you to keep the big picture, which we will always be emphasizing. Now, all of these little vignettes that come after this, you do not need to memorize these at all. You can look through them. I want to particularly note a couple of things. You'll notice the red blood cell here, again, is fairly simple. As you look at the list of things that can happen in a red blood cell, the first thing you remember, it's insulin insensitive. So it's not waiting for insulin, it's using glucose. But notice the only things it can really do are glycolysis and the pentose phosphate pathway. There's not a lot going on in red blood cells. Fairly simple creatures. As you move up to the brain is becoming a bit more complex. Again, really key to the brain is glycolysis and the citric acid cycle. The brain uses a lot of glucose. It's its main energy source. It can also use ketones as fuel. We're not going to talk about this semester, but it's interesting to think about. The brain can use ketones almost as well as it can use glucose as fuel. But note it doesn't use fats at all. So even though fats provide a lot of energy, if you think back to the amount of energy we get from fats, unfortunately the brain cannot take advantage of that. The adipose tissues, notice we're increasing in things that we have going on. There's glycolysis, pentose phosphate pathway, we've got the PDH, we've got glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, so we're storing sugars. And notice lipogenesis, we're making fats in the adipose tissue. And we're not going to talk about the fatty pathways. The muscle cell, again, a lot going on. Don't need to memorize particularly what's going on in each of the organelles, but the muscle's got pretty much everything going on in it. Lots of metabolic pathways. And then the really big one, as simple as red blood cells are, the complexity of the liver is the total opposite end of the scale. Notice in the liver, we've got it all happening in the liver. Liver, really key organelle. Again, it can use glucose without waiting around for insulin. You've got glycolysis, pentose phosphate pathway going on. You've got the PDH, you've got the TCA cycle, or what we call the citric acid cycle. You've got lipids being used, you've got glycogen being synthesized and broken down. Pretty much everything happening in the liver. So again, just kind of look through those, and more than memorize, and you don't need to memorize again, the pathways for the specific organelle. Concentrate instead on that summary picture, which brings together the key intermediates, glucose, 6-phosphate, pyruvate, and acetyl-CoA, and the pathways that we will be studying. But again, marvel at the organelles, the simplicity, going from the simplicity of the red blood cell all the way to the complexity of the liver, and just appreciate that.